Manx Radio's 2016 election coverage.
This hour on the programme, we have another election 2016 candidate interview. Today, we're joined by 62-year-old Kurt Buchholz, who's going to be standing in the newly formed constituency of Douglas Central. Good afternoon, Kurt. Welcome to the programme.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Yeah, as you said, I'm 62 years old. I followed a career at sea when I started. After I made my captain's license in Hamburg, so I went to sea, went through the ranks, worked as a captain for a couple of years, and then went ashore and worked in various companies in senior management. So about 30 years of senior management so far.
Okay, and what sort of ships, just out of interest?
Any kind of ships, like rural ships, container ships, bulk carriers, passenger ships.
Right.
But no tankers.
Must have been an interesting career.
Yeah, you see a lot of the world, not as much most probably as the people saw about 50 years ago, but the interesting bit is now that you have to do a lot of administration, you have to comply with regulations, you have to understand a lot of, about legal terms and contracts, as everything is very regulated, like what we need most probably here on the Isle of Man now. So a good foundation for what we need.
All right, clearly not a Manx accent there. So where did you come from and why did you come to the Isle of Man?
Yeah, I'm German. I was born in Germany and I came to the Isle of Man after I stopped my career on board of ships. I was asked by my company here on the Isle of Man to come ashore, and I worked here, met my wife, married here and stayed here.
Okay. You've had political aspirations for some time now and you've actually stood. Is this your third constituency that you've stood in?
Not really. My target was to stand in the general election 2016, so this year. Then last year, when the Douglas South by-election came up, I knew that 30% of the voters would be merged into Douglas Central. And then Douglas East came up, and 30% of those people are now merged in Douglas Central. So I had the chance already to introduce myself to quite a lot of people who are living now in Douglas Central. But my approach to something new is that I have to get some experience before I could be successful. So anybody who tries to do something for the first time and has no experience will have to learn a lot of things. So this is what I did, and I'm happy that I did that.
Yeah, good stuff. Okay. You're urging everybody to make sure that they register to vote, and you want people to be engaged with politics. I would suggest that probably an awful lot of people aren't very engaged in politics. How do you get the message out to them that it's important?
Yeah, people are very disillusioned, so they do not really know, can they believe anything that people have promised? If you look back to manifestos delivered to the houses 5 years ago, they're nearly identical. All the main subjects are the same. They talk about the health system, they all talk about growing the economy, they talk about education, and they talk about infrastructure projects, and they talk about the vulnerable. And then 5 years later, you get the same kind of manifestos. It looks like they just came out of a phrase printing machine, which exactly the same details. The reason why, and then you look what has happened in the last 5 years, and you realize nearly nothing. And when you ask the candidates here who either tried it the last time or who have been voted in as MHKs, they cannot give an answer why what they promised the voters before hasn't happened. And the reason for me is very simple. They were just unable to deliver.
But can you actually hold candidates accountable for things like that, the things that are said on the manifesto? I mean, that's one of the problems of democracy, isn't it, that you can claim all sorts of things on your manifesto, but there's no check and balance to see whether or not you've done that after 5 years.
Yeah, you can do that. Let's have a look at the vulnerable people. So the people who are older, when I go around canvassing and I see old people living in their houses, either alone or as a couple, in most houses the television is on. Now, for me, these people are vulnerable people because they are pensioners. Sometimes they are 70 or 80 or sometimes even older. And all the MHKs in Tynwald have voted to take the free TV license away. So for a lot of people, this is the window to the world. And if you take that down, you're breaking your promise to protect the vulnerable. It's as simple as that.
Okay. You say that our current crop of politicians aren't really the people to solve the problems that the Isle of Man faces. The worry is that, and it looks as though we are going to end up with a lot of new people in the House of Keys come September, yeah, October time, are they going to have the experience to be able to hit the ground running? Because we don't want to spend forever people learning the job, do we?
You're right. A lot of people from the old guard have decided not to stand again. So what we are losing is a lot of political experience. What we also lose is a lot of old way of thinking, and what we are winning is a chance for a fresh start. And I think this is where we have to look at. And the new people who come in, they do not have to learn from the people who still remain how bad you can govern this island. There has to be a fresh start. For me, the perfect start would be when no MHK, who's presently an MHK, would be re-elected. So you have new people, a fresh start in all departments, in all management. So this is the important bit. And what we need is we need to have a commercial approach, because all the problems we are facing, if it is a promenade, if it is the ferry service agreement, if it is the horse tram, if it is the Vision 9 contract that fell on its back, like all the other contracts. So we can clearly see something is not working. It's in general the management, but we need to increase the business, and that means the income for the Isle of Man. And increasing the income for the Isle of Man, we have to get a good approach to the economy, and that's where the people are lacking.
Do you not think, though, that our politicians are all pretty much decent people who are working the hardest and doing the best for the Isle of Man?
Absolutely. I think there's one thing you can say, that all the candidates are very committed. A lot of candidates are even Manx. I mean, we are 52% of the population on the Isle of Man are not Manx, they are immigrants. And or foreigners, let's call them foreigners, because this word was migrants and immigrants has a pretty bad taste to it. But so 52% are not Manx. And I think the people who are standing, all genuine interest, all would like to bring the Isle of Man forward. But the question is, can they? With the background that some of the people show in their manifestos or in their interviews here, you can clearly say they are not qualified. They do not have anything that qualifies them to control the management. They have nothing to that enables them to win a business or to read even a contract or a budget, because finance, what you heard yesterday from Richard Falk, is very, very important. And if the finance is not right, the island will suffer. But we have two type of people in companies. One are the finance people. The finance people work with information from the past. So they tell you how much we have spent. And then you have the other type of people, the operational side. And that is where I come from, was my expertise. They are winning contracts. They are winning clients. They make contracts. They make sure that you increase the income of a company. They make changes in the management in case it doesn't work. And they make also the figures up that they give to the finance people for the budget. So the budget forecast comes from the operational side. They will tell the finance people how much money we will make with this new contract. So this is how the figures are brought together. So the operational people are the ones who basically are the active people. The other people are just working with the results.
Well, I've heard on our programme from one of our contributors about the fact that MHKs, would-be MHKs, should have to sit an examination before they're allowed to do it. People ought to be trained to do it. I mean, do you go that far in your thinking?
I think it would help if you would say for certain positions you need to have a qualification of some sort. Let's say you have to have a university degree. Then a lot of people will say, no, this is not what policy is about. Everybody should have a chance. But one thing is also clear. Somebody who gets the votes from and will be voted in does not get with the votes the competence that is required for the job.
Okay,
so overnight you will not become a competent candidate.
Isn't that the strength and the weakness of democracy as we know it, though? That, you know, a butcher, baker, a candlestick maker can all stand and achieve the highest office in the land, because, you know, it's a government of the people by the people, surely.
Yeah, absolutely. This is why I said democracy allows people, even with no qualifications, to go in, because people think they represent them. If you have a postman who comes for 20 years in the same area, people will say, oh, he's my postman. He can deliver the post very good. He should be my MHK. But then you have to ask these people, when you give them the vote, what is your postman doing to achieve for you? And that's what every voter is interested in. What is in for me?
Yes.
So when you ask this question, you have to give the voters an idea what you will do for them. For me, for Douglas Central, for example, it's very important that we look at the problems that we have in Douglas Central. We have the main routes going through Douglas where the people go to work. So this kind of roads suffer the most because there are so many cars driving up and down every day. Those roads need to have priority when the roads are repaired, and not roads like the Slock where nobody goes up and down, maybe on the weekend some people. So it shows us very clearly that the priorities have to be on certain issues. For us in Douglas Central, it's that one with the roads. It's also the chaos around the schools. Every morning there's a complete breakdown of traffic around the schools. So the police and also the MHK for that area has to come up with a solution. Another problem is that beside or a little bit away from the main roads, we have the small roads, and it's very quiet and it's a very nice area to live in. We have a very nice neighborhood there. But a lot of times you cannot use even the pavements because the hedges are growing completely over the pavement. So we should tidy up the area. And I think there are, these are the things where we could say this is where we could improve for Douglas Central.
Well, and these are constituency issues, and that's part of the job of being an MHK. But yeah. How big a part of being an MHK should constituency issues be? And how much of those could be delegated effectively to the local authority?
And I mean, this is an interesting question, but it's also very complex. You have to say that the government here on the Isle of Man is so, or the administration on the Isle of Man for the government is so extensive that it is not logical to have that. We are a very small nation. We're not a country, we're a nation, and we are very small. We have a little bit more than 80,000 people here. What we need is a policy that suits our nation, the size of the nation. We are completely we have an oversized government, we have an oversized administration that all has to be slimmed down. When you look how many employed people we have on the Isle of Man, something like 38,000, 17,000 of these are government employees. So it's about half of the population is just working for the government, and that shows us also how the imbalance is there. And yesterday we heard that in the hospital, for example, 30% are medical staff and 70% are management staff. So this is not right. We can clearly say the hat is too heavy.
So what do you do about that, though? If you're elected, you'll be a new MHK. What can you actually do to change any of that? Can you do anything?
Yeah, as when you worked in management, and that does not mean you have a one-man or self-employed company where you say, I'm very experienced in management and senior management because I'm the company director and I'm the only person. So that is not the experience you need. When you work with a lot of people in bigger groups, you will find that one of the important things is that you understand how people are working. You form a team, and the people will respect certain members of this team very quickly as the people who are the driving factors in a team. It's not that you tell the people exactly what to do. What you do is you gather information, and out of this information, you extract the main points which interest all of the people in that team, and then you put this together and you present the extract to them and say, okay, that's what we all agree, that's the way forward.
But so if you're elected, it's probably unlikely that you get a government department straight away, but the fact of the matter is that as a single MHK, you've got no political affiliations as such, would you be able to get the vote to set up some sort of an efficiency committee or whatever to look at things like that, and could you then get a vote passed to make any real change? It's all very well seeing this of the problem, and a lot of people say that we're overgoverned, we've got far too many people on the government payroll. But you know, I think it's probably more difficult to change that than people think.
That is true, but I'm not really interested in what is called on the Isle of Man the backbencher's position, because the backbencher's position is like a passenger on a train that observes what the other people are doing. And I heard some of the MHK sitting here on this radio station making comments and said, I thought that in government I cannot be as effective as a backbencher, and that is completely nonsense. You can only make decisions and have an impact of what is happening in the government when you are in a position where you take responsibility and you make decisions. You will be exposed to criticism, no problem. But if you're not prepared to make decisions and take responsibility, you're not the right person for Tynwald.
Well, you've been fairly critical of current MHK's work ethic. So you seem to think that MHKs ought to work an awful lot harder and longer. My impression has always been that MHKs work pretty long hours already. So am I wrong in that?
Yes, you are. Because first we have a lot of unsolved problems. So then they have to work as hard as possible to solve those problems. But the second thing is, any person who sat here and who's at the moment an MHK said to you, oh, I initiated this committee and I initiated that working group. So they all seem to set up meetings and they all produce something. But why do we not see any results? It is not efficient when you set up meetings. If you go to the government departments and you sit there and you are in there and you see what they are doing, they all head at a certain time to the meetings. Most of them with a cup of coffee in their hand, most probably. Some of them put their arms over their head when they sit down on the chair, and then the palaver starts for an hour, and then they go out and they think this is very important, and that's how you have to make policy and solve our problems. I'm sorry, that is not the way how you solve problems. For me, in management, especially senior management, the management meetings will be before 9 o'clock and after 5 o'clock, and you will see how efficient they are and how quickly they can finish.
So you think that MHKs at the moment monitor things too much, that they talk too much, that they have pointless meetings, and they should actually roll up the sleeves and get stuck in?
Yeah. When I was here for this 4-minute interview a couple of days ago, I said something, and I don't know if people understood what I was saying. The non-decision-making decisions. So they all decide if it's Lawrence Skelly with Vision 9 or if it's Phil Gorn with the revolving door policy on the promenade. All these things come back because they cannot make a decision. What the government has to deliver, and we as voters or the people here, the residents, can expect from the politicians is they present turnkey projects. And not a half-baked meal where afterwards they say, oh, we forgot this ingredient and we forgot that ingredient and that department hasn't decided to agree to this one because we haven't shown them the plan. If you do something with the promenade and you come up with a plan, you have to expect that they invite the people from planning to be a part of this. And when everything is agreed, that plan will be put forward and you can execute when it's decided from Tynwald. And not that once you have agreed to all these plans in the DOI, then the planning department comes and says no. I mean, what kind of government is this? This is just a joke. They have to prepare and make turnkey projects.
All right. You say that there's a decline in the economy, but surely the island's got unbroken economic growth despite the financial crisis. So, you know, surely the.
Can I say something to that?
Right.
You said permanent economic growth. I extracted some figures from something that the government releases. It's called Isle of Man in Numbers 2016. And the data says the following: bank deposits since 2008. Down 30%. Funds under management down 63%. Number of companies registered on the Isle of Man 30% down. Number of new companies registered on the Isle of Man down 56%. Treasury receipts down 20%. Passenger movements down 10%. And then the most interesting bit might be that the government released also in the same document figures how much income they have. And when they show you how much income they have and how much they spend. So they say the government income in 14-15 was 934 million and the government expenditure altogether in 14-15 was 819. So then you add up the figures because they break down where they are spending the money. And it comes up with a complete different figure. It's the government spending is not 890. When you add it up on the computer on Excel, you come to 931, which is very close to the income. And then I checked with all the previous years, and not one number is correct. Now, I can tell you that when you have a Treasury department that produces figures which don't add up, you should question in general how valuable the information is that these people release.
All right. You're unhappy with public sector pensions, and an awful lot of people are citing that as the biggest threat that we've got at the moment. What's your answer to that?
Yeah, public sector pension, I think it's if we want to talk about this, we have to talk about real figures. So we have to find out first, financially, where do we stand? With the income that I mentioned before, we are nearly break even. So this is, we balance the books. That was the key phrase that they used last year. But with the pensions, it is first we have to establish how much money do we have to pay for the pensions. So if we still continue paying for the pensions, that is the best solution. But there's also one thing. A pension fund is based on solidarity. You pay in every month a certain amount, and when you are retired, you get a certain amount out every month. When you agree now that people from the public sector pension or who receive a public pension, they are allowed to get the full payout in one go. I can tell you that in half year, in 1 year, the money is completely finished. We are run out of money and then we are bankrupt. So it's not solidarity when we give these people the money and they ride off into the sunset because they know in 2 years there will be no more money when everybody does it. So everybody wants to have now a full payout, and that is completely not acceptable.
All right. You say, like every candidate says, that we need to increase the economy and we need to make things better. We need to diversify more. You say that tourism's got the biggest potential in terms of growth. How would you do that? How would you grow the tourism economy?
Yeah, it's tourism. It's also the growth of the, let's say, renewable energy. And it is the businesses that we have. The businesses are willing to invest. So we need investment. And for tourism, especially, we need to have access to the Isle of Man. That must be affordable. You cannot have additional £300 or £500 if you book a cabin on a ship with a car and two passengers. You're close to £500. If you add that to a holiday, comparable to a holiday in the Lake District, the people will go to the Lake District or they will go somewhere else. But this additional money should not be there. And then we also do not have the right attractions on the Isle of Man. We do not have the right accommodation. people are not coming to the Isle of Man to have a city break. They come here because they love the nature. So if we want to have, if we want to develop tourism, we have to allow certain parts of the Isle of Man to be developed for tourism. And now people will come, oh no, that's not possible. We don't want to have something here. We do not want to have a holiday resort here. We don't want to have a hotel. We have to make a decision. Do we want to grow the tourism or not? So if we agree we want to, we have to make it attractive. And turnkey project again. There are certain stakeholders. There are the people bringing the tourists over. There are the people who provide accommodation. And there is the government who has to provide our national heritage, because national heritage is a part of tourist attraction. So if we take the horse tram away, the Luxi wheel away, and the electric railway, then we only have green fields. They look still very beautiful, but a part of the attraction is gone.
All right. So, I mean, you're talking about tourism and we ought to have more hotels. Could you keep them full or reasonably full year round? Because that's the problem. I don't know if I had millions of pounds spare, I would want to build a hotel in the Isle of Man.
Yeah, you're right. If we look, for example, at Centre Parks, which is the Centre Parks in the Lake District, they are booked throughout the year. Good weather, bad weather, winter time, summer time. So if we would have something like that here, we could attract people as well.
But
and
the difference
the surrounding.
Is that they've got a catchment area of 60 million people and we've got a local catchment area a lot smaller, or you've got to pay a lot of money to come over on a boat or an aeroplane.
Yeah, and this is where the setup with the ferry service is wrong. I think we should look at the model that we have at the moment, which is a profit model. It's a private-owned company owned by shareholders. They're only interested in one thing, that's profit.
But we've got a user agreement that runs to, what, 2025? So is there anything actually that can be done about that?
Yeah, the actual agreement runs to 2020, and then there's an option to extend it. But if we, as the government, would tell the steam packet company, there will be no extension, we will have a ferry service, but it will be different to what we have now, they will not seek for the extension, most probably. But the steam packet makes £10 million profit a year, £10 million profit. And the Isle of Man government has done something, and now I come back to the commercial approach that they should show. The Isle of Man gave away this agreement for free. So they give a contract away to a company that makes 10 million profit a year, and for the next 10 years they will make 100 million profit. In other areas where you give a license away, you charge a license fee. So if we were charged from the 100 million profit that the steam packet makes, only 50 million, that can go an infrastructure project and we will be very nice off.
All right, you say that we should be less dependent on things like e-gaming and banking, but surely those are areas that we're in that we're successful at, so it's easier to grow them than anything else, isn't it?
Yeah, but I was talking about diversifying the economy further. So what we have, we should keep, and we should make it an attractive place for companies to be here. That means a competitive platform. That's what we have to provide to people.
And you'd like to see the number of consultants that we employ limited as well. Isn't that, though, because sometimes we reach an impasse between different factions and you need somebody from the outside to come along and say, actually, you ought to do this?
For sure, there might be in very special cases the situation where we have to employ consultants and have to ask them. But I have to say, the government departments for sure have a lot of department knowledge. And when I talk to people on the door and they say to me, we are in the Department of Infrastructure, we are involved in the refurbishment of the promenade or regeneration, and we are not listened to, but we have all the expertise. So then you think either this person is not very well liked in the department, he just tells me some porkies, or you have to say, yes, we have this expertise and we do not need consultants. So, but why are the politicians asking the consultants? Because they don't know what to do either. So instead of asking their own people, they go abroad and ask people and pay a fortune for that. If you look who Phil Gorn has asked for the ferry user agreement and for his proposals, he asked a company that was established 2014. There are four people working there in London. So I do not know what they paid, but for sure, such consultants we wouldn't need if we would have competent people here.
What's the answer to the promenade in Douglas?
Refurbishment of a mile of road in the UK is about, or if you put a new tarmac top on, it's about £300,000 per mile. So the mile is the promenade is 2 miles long, so it would be £600,000. We have spent now over £1 million on planning, so we can put all the planning papers there and it would be smooth. But we need tarmac.
Okay, so just re-tarmac it and don't waste any more money on it. I mean, people would say, well, yeah, you can't do that because the foundations need to be dug up. It's not as simple as people make out.
Yeah, that's what they say. But the tarmac that we can see now is, I was told, was laid there before the Second World War, because you still can see the indents where the poles were when they put the internees here. So if we put tarmac there and it lasts 60 years, I think brilliant. That is the solution for us.
And finally, tell the people of Douglas Central why they should vote for Kurt Buchholz.
Because as an extract of the whole interview that we did, so I think the people will have a quite good idea what I'm standing for. I have business experience, I have commercial approach to a lot of things. The details I told you about, the roads that we have to repair, the main roads where most of the traffic for Douglas passes through, Hatches, nice neighbourhood, the schools have to be improved and it has to be safe. And for me, I would like to see the local policeman on the street more often.
All right, candidate for Douglas Central, Kurt Buchholz, thanks for joining us today.
Keep up to date with the latest House of Keys General Election 2016 coverage on manxradio.com.